locked in.
I have a little sticky. There seems to be honey on my control panel here, but I got it locked in. It's GloucesterCast 230. We have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 today. Lucky 7. And we have some very special guests. We have guests that we've been trying to get on the podcast for at least a year and a half, maybe 2 years. But Chris Munkholm is here from the Gloucester Biotechnology Academy. I'm very, very excited to have you here because I think it's one of the probably the least known things in Gloucester that is one of the most positive and potentially the most incredible impact that could potentially have on this city when we talk about the type of jobs and the type of, you know, there's all this rhetoric about what we want to bring to Gloucester. And, you know, there's a lot of people that don't like tourism, even though I think that everything has its place in Gloucester. But we always, you know, for probably 20 years, they've been talking about, you know, we it's a natural fit that we should have, genomic and DNA sequencing and stuff like that for in relation to the marine field. And Gloucester Biotechnology Academy is the seedling for this, what is potentially just an explosive, what, you know, it is explosive in Cambridge and all over the world, but we have what could be a center right here in Gloucester. So welcome, Chris Munkholm.
Well, thank you so much.
We also have Andrea Bodner. Did I say your last name right?
That's correct.
And she's, we're breaking news right here. She is new to the Gloucester Biotechnology Academy as the science director. Is that right?
That's correct.
And how did they lure you here to Gloucester?
Gloucester is a beautiful place.
Oh, believe
me. Culture and history, and it's been fantastic, actually. Everyone has been very welcoming, very friendly. It's been great to make a move to Gloucester.
Did they reach out to you, or did you reach out to them?
I had known them for a couple of years now, and ultimately they reached out to me after a two-year.
Yeah, she spoke at one of our little mini science forums, and she's doing research on the sea urchin about their longevity and their cancer resistance. And so we saw somebody who really had with biotechnology skills.
Yeah.
And so she was really doing wonderful work, and she'll be continuing that as one of the projects here. But it took a couple of years.
Yeah. All right, we're going to get to that story. We've got Jerry Shine. Jerry Shine, where'd the book go? Who took the book? There's the book. Jerry Shine, a year underwater. He spent 12 months diving, fraternizing with marine life, and just having a great time from the St. Lawrence River to the West Palm Beach. I'm going to talk to him in a little bit. Nicole Schraff, Good Morning Gloucester contributor, did a great job with Fiesta coverage. Thank you, Nicole.
Thanks for that lead-in after all of that. Yeah. Great job of the Fiesta.
You're an integral part of the blog, though. You do a great job with it. Every Thursday, she does our roundup of great family activities. Ed Collard here.
In the house.
Legend.
Ready.
He's been traveling the East Coast. He's back home right now for who knows how long.
Yeah, I don't know.
Who knows?
I'm having a good time.
Who knows? And we have Paul Morrison here, who shows up like about one every 15 podcasts. He drops some knowledge on us, and then he goes about his business with his strange rubber duck obsession that he has.
And I was only going to stay for 10 minutes, but I didn't know the whole lineup was complete science, so I'm staying for the whole thing.
Oh, wow! We got him locked in.
Breaking news.
I love it. All right. We're going to start out talking about the Gloucester Biotechnology Academy. And I have the student handbook here, but you know the reason I've been trying to get you on for so long is because I recognize that, I mean, this academy, there's 20 students per semester. Is that
20
what
students
per
maximum?
Year?
Yes, our first class we graduated 13.
And after that, they have internships.
Well, that's built into the program. The program is one academic year, and we launched last September after 15 months of putting together the curriculum, building out a gorgeous teaching facility up at Blackburn Industrial Park.
Which a lot of people, the seed money came from some heavy
very
hitters, right?
Generous, I mean, philanthropists, heavy hitters who really wanted to see this happen for years. Mm. It's all about bringing new opportunities to the Cape Ann area, to Gloucester, you know, bringing the biotechnology, some of the biotechnology economy up here, but combining it with more of a marine emphasis.
And but Gloucester already has some heavy hitters in this industry as residents, or not just
as
Gloucester, Cape Ann, is right?
Oh yeah, they're squirreled away. People who have been major influencers, and they became involved with this other citizens who wanted to see what can we do here to create a biotechnology community and economic driver. So, and you need a biotechnology workforce. So the first project we rolled out was a biotech Gloucester Biotechnology Academy to start training local people to work in the industry. And the focus was on high school graduates. It's not a program. It's not like a four-year or six-year degree program. Mm-hmm. It's a one-year lab immersion course where high school graduates learn all of the basic skills you need to operate as a technician in any lab. And the students we recruited had, they weren't science nerds, they weren't planning to do this with their lives, but they were intrigued by it. And they started last September, and we were amazed how well they did. They really got into it. And there's something, we think there's something about the hands-on experience of science that can really interest people in a way that just the lecture doesn't. So there's one semester, they study DNA techniques 5 days a week, 3-4 hours a day in the lab. Then the next semester is all about proteins, because DNA and protein go together. Mm-hmm. And then the third semester is a paid internship.
Can I mention one thing? I'll just stop you for 1 second. You know how we get the blue lobsters?
One out of two million, I think it is. Isn't that right,
Paul? There are numbers.
Well, Joey's technique of bringing the blue lobsters in and then collecting them and dropping them off at the end of the harbor, that 1 in 2 million is going to start dropping, because it's homozygous recessive, and you're going to get, like corn, it's hybrid crosses. It's probably down to 1 out of 5,000 now.
But after doing a little bit of...
So you have a collection of these?
Well, I don't keep them because I don't think... People freak out if you, like, keep them. They're like, that should go back into the ocean. So rather than deal with the aggravation of listening to the people that tell me that it's terrible to keep them for anyone to look at, you know, just much like Shamu or anything else, you have to release them back into the wild, or politically correct, you get absolutely annihilated online, because that's how we live our lives now, is by what the masses, what one person that with any influence has to say about you. That's how you're labeled for the rest of your life. So I'd try to avoid any kind of controversy.
We could do the DNA sequence. We need a very small amount of tissue to do the DNA.
Who do I need? So just
and then
drop
you can,
off.
You can return that blue lobster back to the ocean.
So drop off.
Give us a little
so
bit
you
of
give
tissue.
Me a contact. I will make sure that they get up there, because we get a lot of interesting creatures here that have these type of protein. Because what it is it's an abundance of a certain protein that creates that blue shell, right?
Mm-hmm. It's actually the lack of that shows the blue through. I think.
But when you cook it, it still turns white.
Right. Oh, red, yeah. Yeah.
I mean, there's calico, there's blue.
Yeah. Albino, right?
You know, I've seen really, hybrids half and half.
The really interesting thing is, on the back of the head of the shell of the lobster, is it called the carapace, I think? I think it's the carapace.
And it's on a turtle. Huh? That much. On a turtle, it's called the carapace.
Okay, so the carapace, there's a straight line that goes, if you look at it really closely, there's a straight line that goes right down the back. And some lobsters that we've got are, I mean, it could not be more 90 degrees of white on one side and regular side on the other side, or an entire leg or a walking leg just blue.
Yeah,
so the blue lobsters that the number that so it's funny, I always poke fun of the New England Aquarium. Because whenever they get like a calico lobster, which over the course of the year we probably get about 15 to 20 of them, and we don't handle 15 to 20 million pounds a year, but they're, you know, they put the picture on their social media saying we have this rare calico lobster, 1 in 20, you know, 15 million, and I'm like, and I just You know, it's just like, you guys got to be better than this. You know, they're not that rare. And I'm sorry for interrupting you, but I just thought that that was interesting.
It is interesting.
Yeah.
But if you, as I said, you know, a very small amount of tissue, we can get the DNA sequence. So if you find something out there that you think is, you know, of interest, bring us a very little bit, send that lobster back to the ocean.
Well, I'm not going to bring it to you. Someone's going to come pick it up,
we'll
and then they can
it
return it.
Yeah.
So just, all, before you leave, just give me the contact information, email preferably, of who I should contact. I'll keep it.
Mm-hmm.
I'll keep it taped right here, and then I'll get a hold of you guys. That would be pretty interesting to see if we could, if something could happen, you know,
that's
come
great
of that, and then you could report back to us, the, you know, whatever kind of interesting things that you found out about it, and then generate more interest.
That's right.
It's all about generate. That's what we do
that's
here.
That's right. Yeah, absolutely.
We're all about that. So, Andrea, what are some of the type of things that you're going to do at the Biotech Academy that haven't been done before?
So to complement the Biotech Academy, the next phase is to build a research institute. So this is going to be the Gloucester Marine Genomics Institute. This will be the research arm of the organization. And basically what we're going to do there is, again, the foundation will be in genomics, and it will be bringing genomics to marine science. For applications in fishery, for drug discovery from the sea, to find new medicines from marine sources, there are a lot of fascinating things in the ocean that we
some things that I've heard. I don't know if it's rumored or what the facts are, because you hear things. Horseshoe crab blood, dogfish, which are, you know, sand shark, the bones in them, there's some kind of beneficial things. Are you familiar with either
yes
of those?
Yeah, both of them, actually. There's a tremendous amount of biodiversity in the ocean, and there are some adaptations of these organisms that are absolutely have direct applications to human medicine and to various applications that are useful to humans. So for the horseshoe crab in particular, the immune system is really, really effective at clotting. And so when it's exposed to a bacteria endotoxin, it has a very strong clotting reaction, and we've been able to use this as a way of detecting really low levels of bacteria or bacteria endotoxin. And at the moment, we test all things that are injected into humans, etc., go through a test to make sure they're free of endotoxin, free of bacteria, and that test comes from the horseshoe crab. So that's one example of how we've used something for marine environment for a practical application that has direct benefits to human health.
I think it's actually been commercialized into a company down on Cape Cod.
Mm-hmm.
It's a diagnostic company that extracts the blood from the horseshoe and uses that.
Is it possible to do you have to keep getting horseshoe crabs to create this stuff, or can you use something to?
This is the beauty of genetics and genomics approaches. So we understand the enzymes that are doing this clotting reaction, so we can actually just take the DNA that encodes those enzymes and recreate the kit without having to use horseshoe crabs. So again, with genomics, these kind of things become sustainable without having to go back to the ocean to continue
and clean them
to
out
collect organisms.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Once we have the genetic information, we can use that then to make these products.
What's cool about the blue that company down on Cape Cod, they collect the horseshoe crabs, they put them on the rack, they get a little blue blood out of them, and in the afternoon they put them back in the ocean.
Wow. Mm. So they're not all evil corporations looking to take every last horseshoe crab out of the ocean for financial benefit. Is that what you're saying?
Science.
I think their recovery rate is greater than 90% for the horseshoe crabs for bleeding them that way. But again, applying a genomics approach, you can completely eliminate having to stress the animals.
That's amazing. So, what are the things with the dogfish bones or cartilage?
So there's a long-standing history of understanding that there's something about cartilage that can inhibit the growth of blood vessels, for example, and that actually has applications for controlling growth of tumors. And so we've been trying to understand the components of how that works. And a number of animals that have a lot of cartilage are animals that are great to study for understanding inhibitors of angiogenesis, which can become treatments for cancer in terms of preventing cancer growth by preventing blood vessels to supply nutrients to the cancer.
Jesus, all this stuff is it is fascinating. And here we have this opportunity in Gloucester to have our children become part of this thing that's growing exponentially right in front of us. The opportunity is just I mean, we are so blessed. Usually all this stuff goes down at the Woods Hole. I'm so sick of those Southie politicians funneling all that money down the south of Boston. And finally, we get something north of Boston where all the good stuff should be happening. And this is just great opportunities.
This is a perfect location for Marine Genomics Institute. It's just an hour drive to Cambridge if you want to, you know, hang out with that group. But, you know, Marine, we got to be on the ocean. And here's Gloucester with this incredible maritime infrastructure. We've already been helped by the Anasquam Field Station over here.
Molly Luskovich.
This is a field science. You need people who understand the ocean, how to get across it, how to get down, how to find those spawning grounds. So I see, you know, Gloucester just perfect place for Marine Genomics Institute. So.
One point about the training in this institute, they sequence the cod genome. They do a lot of stuff with the proteins with the cod, mm-hmm. but they learn how to do a diverse number of things that are applicable to everything. Kyle, who is interning in my lab, is...
Paul, what's the name of your lab?
It's the Molecular Biology Core Facilities at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, where we do a lot of genomic sequencing.
I want to just interrupt right here. This is Paul Morrison speaking. Good morning, Gloucester, the crazy guy with the duck. But he's speaking, dropping some knowledge right here. He's not just a guy, an insane person that walks around taking pictures with a duck. He actually has some practical knowledge, and he's a director of this molecular. You wouldn't know it from his posts. Actually, other than that, you're also very interested in the moon phases and stuff like that.
My father taught astronomy merit badge, so I got dragged outside
there you go.
Every night.
But I'm sorry for interrupting. Do you say a director?
Founding director of the Molecular Biology Core Facilities.
Molecular Biology Core Facilities, Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. Okay.
Faculty, so, Harvard Medical School, blah, blah, blah.
Blah, blah, blah. Big time. Right, the office right outside of Fenway Park, like, has his own parking spot right there. So that's how I know he's big time. That's how I know he's big time.
No, that's why you know I'm a professional whiner, but sometimes it pays off.
There you go.
And that parking spot was absolutely...
critical.
Had to whine a lot.
My favorite part about that parking spot is when I go to the games, you let me park in your spot. You tell me to wave up at the camera, and then you take a screenshot of me of waving up at the camera from your office.
I have a whole set of them. They're very amusing.
So bringing it back, because that's what we're going to do right now. We're going
to
bring it back.
Back to the
you actually have an intern working at your joint from the Gloucester Biotechnology Academy. Is that right?
Correct.
How did that come to be?
Well, Mark Vidal is a big part of the GMGI. Mark is faculty at Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. I live in Rockport, so I bump into all these people all the time. And when they started releasing some of these students, I knew that if they were sequencing on a aluminum iSeq, and they had all the training for pre and post op of that machine, I knew I could use them in my lab. So Kyle is doing a couple of different projects right now in my lab, single cell sequencing of pediatric brain tumors. You know, it's not COD, yeah. But he's getting a lot of useful information out of it. And a few other things like that, but mostly, you know, we're a cancer institute, so.
So what do you think are going to be some opportunities that will be in front of him from between, you know, his time with the Gloucester Biotechnology Academy and in your office?
Well, that's a good question, and the skill set you get out of this, it's just, if I were to tell somebody who is graduating from high school or college, what's a fallback position, or, you know, what's going to pay well in the next 20, 30 years, it would be biotechnology. and it would be the skill set built around biotechnology and molecular biology, and that's what they give them. And then you have bioinformatics and what you do with computers with the data that comes out of the biotechnology, that it's a field that's exploding because, I mean, I make, my lab right now makes 10 terabytes of data every day, and we don't know what to do with all of it. It's, we can slice and dice about a third of it, get useful information out of it, but it's too much data. We spread it out amongst 180 other labs so we can figure, we can get the biggest bang for the buck out of all that data. But bioinformatics, just writing programming for biotechnology and genetics and molecular biology, I could just throw out 10 more buzzwords,
yeah.
But it's all right there. And
yeah.
This is, the training that they're getting in here, it's the great skill set foot in the door where I didn't have to think very long and hard to sign Kyle up because I knew I could put him in front of the bench and he could be
learning curve is
working on samples right away. And then from going to lab meetings from there on out, he can sky's the limit on adding to his skill set.
Yeah, unbelievable. So what are the steps that a potential student needs to take to be part of this incredible opportunity?
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you. I really appreciate everything you just said about Kyle. He was our first student, and it's wonderful to see. He was the one that was working in Dunkin' Donuts. Now he's at Dana-Farber. So going forward, the class of 2018 is enrolled. But we will start the process for the class of 2019 this coming winter. So if this is of interest and somebody wants to participate, they should be tracking our communications. We'll be having an open house. We'd like to meet, the instructors and teachers. We also offer an opportunity for somebody to come to the school for 2 or 3 hours and sort of shadow another student.
Yeah.
And if that's of interest, then applications will be accepted next January, and we'll start that process. And you can learn about the requirements at that time.
And what age are they eligible?
The spread right now is about 18 to 26, 27. Mm-hmm. So, even if you've been out of high school for a while and you've been doing something and doesn't seem to be a direction that you like, here's an opportunity to make a switch and get into the biotech professional pathway.
Beautiful. Anything you'd like to add in closing?
Well, and looking forward, we also are going to be adding other science education programs to our facility, which was used only 22 weeks out of the year. Mm-hmm. So we want this to become eventually a KPAN Science Education Center. So if you don't want to do the vocational program, there will be summer camps, there will be vacation camps, other things like that.
Wow.
So, and all based on genomics and biotechnology.
Well, thank you guys so much for coming in. It was worth the wait. I recognized early on. John Bell, reached
great.
Out to me, great
yeah.
guy, former mayor, and telling me about this originally. And if anyone can't see how great of an opportunity, that's why I was so anxious to get you guys in here to talk about it because, the word, if it isn't out there, it just needs to be spread because we, Gloucester, is so blessed to have you guys
thank
here.
You so much.
Yeah.
I appreciate it.
Thanks for coming in again. All right. So we're back recording. Paul, do you hear me? So tell me about the new crescent moon.
There's my amateur astronomy part. As everybody has noticed, the king tides have been going by. The new moon was 2 days ago.
Big tide today.
Big tide.
Yeah, like a foot and a half or something, right? 18 inches or something?
High highs and
low lows. Yeah.
That's because the moon and the sun are in the same spot in the sky. But as yesterday, the moon lags behind, the sun sets, and yesterday 1.3% of the crescent moon was sitting there, but unfortunately there was a little bit of cloud in the sky. And I didn't see it, but somebody else might have been able to see the first edge of the crescent moon. But tonight, if you look outside, it's really clear. It's going to be clear at sunset tonight. So if you're doing fiesta or whatever, at sunset, it starts getting a little bit dark. Go to any place, top of the Ferris wheel, wherever, and look to where the sun just set. And if you look a little bit to the left and up, there's going to be a fingernail of moon. And because it's the, it's a super crescent moon, so it's just going to be a little bit bigger than you've ever seen it.
There you go.
9:02 this evening. But you know, either side, 20 minutes, it'll be sitting out there.
So there's a little window there, like 8:42 to.
I think the moon sets at 9:30 or 9:40, so you've got a decent chunk of time. If it's perfectly clear all the way down the horizon, you'll be able to watch it go all the way down. And if you get in a good spot, like right here, it'll be.
Yeah.
Won't it be? Right above City Hall.
Yep, right around there. Yeah, very cool. Well, thank you for that information. I love your. I'm not necessarily into astrology, but I love the way you. The one thing I really not. I'm not gonna say the one thing, as opposed to the inane fucking duck things that you post. I actually do enjoy looking at your maps with the with the directions on where the sun's setting and all the interesting facts about that. That is value added stuff as opposed to the nonsense with the duck. So there you go. Got that going for you.
You got me.
Here you go. Jerry Shine is here. Jerry Shine. Not his stage name. Not his pen name.
That's a real name.
His real name. Jerry, I spaced out. I totally forgot that the people from the Genome Interest, because I've had so many, they've said that they potentially are going to come and they flake out. Like a bunch of times, they finally came on the same day that Jerry Shine has spent 12 months diving and fraternizing with marine life up and down the East Coast. So that was probably pretty interesting for you, that segment.
It was interesting, but it was also intimidating because hear people talking about genome sequencing and molecular studying the molecules and tumors, and I just go down and look at this stuff and interact with it and photograph it.
But so, what was the impetus for the book?
Well, I've been diving for close to 40 years, and I do much of my diving around here. And we are sort of blessed in that we are one of the few places in the world that people can dive right off of the beach. Most places, you have to get on a boat, you have to go miles offshore before you see anything.
Okay.
You have to go to a reef or a shipwreck. But here, because we have such a rocky coastline, there's invertebrate life attached all around it, and fish are coming in to feed on it, and it just steps off of the beach is an underwater world that's very interesting, very worth seeing. But because you can dive off of the beach, you're constantly interacting with people who are just walking by, and you become a part of their day as you're gearing up or gearing down before or after a dive. And invariably, people are asking, what do you see down there? But they're asking you this as they walk by. So how do you answer a question like that in the 30 seconds before they have to take off? You can't. And so this book is my answer, finally, to what it is that I see down there.
So I want to just say, it's a real deal book. It's not it's not like some, hunky fudunky book. Sometimes you see some hunky fudunky books. This is like real deal.
Not a hunky fudunky book.
Yeah, it's beautiful. Where did you have it published?
A small publisher, Blue Sphere Pubs, and they've published all three of my books.
So when you decided, so you've been diving for 40 years,
yeah,
and then you decided I'm going to take a year and do this. What was the purpose to compare what you're seeing in different dive locations?
The book expanded. Initially, I was just going to dive in Folly Cove in Gloucester for an entire year and just write about the changes that took place there. But it just seemed to me that I couldn't spend enough time in the water to observe all of the changes that would fill an entire book. So I expanded it to all of Massachusetts and then all of New England. And at some point I said, why don't I just make it the whole East Coast?
Well, more interesting sell. The sell, we're diving from, Montreal to
yeah, you got a bigger audience.
You got a bigger audience.
More people are
more interesting. Like,
yeah.
and to the compare and contrast and everything.
Yeah, and it's basically how marine life changes from place to place and then through the year as well.
Wow, there's a lot there.
There's a lot there. There's so much fascinating stuff.
What are some of the things that, like, people say you're at Good Harbor Beach? What are some of the things that people don't realize are just like lurking around, like, because I freak out. Like, if I can't see the bottom, I really don't want to be in the ocean.
Yeah.
It's just like I have one of the. It's like kind of a fear of mine. You know, like heights. Like I don't like lakes either. If I don't know what's underneath my toes, yeah. I don't want to go in there.
Yeah. But, well, Good Harbor, so very sandy. Yeah. So there's going to be a little bit less there until you get out to Salt Island. Mm-hmm. But as I've come in there, you know, come in underwater, and I see people swimming, and it's sort of like that scene from Jaws where you see the legs, you know, and they're kicking, yeah. And then there are stripers swimming all, you know, in and around them, and there are sculpin and sea raven are on the bottom that are just sort of, they're just
being
laying
ugly.
There. They're not moving.
Sitting there being ugly. The
yeah,
way they do.
Right. Yeah. So that's the amazing thing is how much stuff is right there within steps of the beach.
Yeah.
You know, so as you're sitting there on the beach, looking out over the water, if you're like me and you're wondering what's going on under there right now, the answer is a lot right there.
Now with lobsters, so you've spent a lot of time. You see what are some of in this area in particular? What is some of what are some of the cycles a diver would see under the water with the life cycle of the lobster, as far as molting to hardening of the shell? Where do you see like movements of lobsters in different times of the year?
Well, lobsters are they move offshore when the water gets cold. Mm-hmm. Their life cycle is that when they're very young, they stay under the cobble and they will stay there under some football sized rocks. And they'll stay there for a year or two. But then once they've molted a few times and they get a little bit bigger, now they come out. And when the water starts to get too cold, they'll migrate offshore into deeper water. And then they'll come back in the spring. And so that's what we see, is that sometime around May, June, July, they're back in. You're starting to see more of them at some point. Particularly if you dive at night, which I do a lot, I love to go underwater after dark. That's when you start to see in July or August, after the lobsters have been around for a while, you start to see them walking around and they have no claws. Or you'll see lobsters that have one leg on one side and two legs on the other. Yeah, and they've been preyed on by stripers or by other lobsters in battles. And then as you get into the year again, further into the year, then they start to disappear. They're moving offshore, except for the very big ones. The really big ones, they have a tendency to stick around. It's like they can ride out whatever our winter is going to throw at them.
Residence.
And so they don't need to get out into deeper water. Uh-huh. But that's talking like 15 to 20-pound lobsters.
Hmm. Residence. And the V-notching has probably helped. Because those lobsters get thrown back.
Oh yeah.
So there's more of them. There's probably. Have you seen an increase in the amount of larger lobsters that have?
No,
been?
I've seen an increase in the number of small lobsters.
Yeah. That's healthy.
Yeah, but I have not seen an increase in the number of big lobsters around here. If you go further north, like northern Maine and Canada, then you start to see very big lobsters, 15 to 20-pound lobsters. And around here, I have seen like one that was probably 12 to 15 pounds that was living in Folly Cove. And he or she was there for a few years. But there were, at one point, I don't know that it's still the case. It probably still is the case. At one point, there seemed to be so many small lobsters that you were seeing them walking about during the day. It was almost as if there wasn't enough places for them all to hide.
Wow.
You know, there weren't enough crevices.
Now, a lot of times my lobstermen will catch, they'll set their gear in what they call the bottom, called the mud. Or they'll set it in anticipation. Because do the lobsters, they bury themselves in the mud?
It depends on the bottom. They're there, and whatever is there, they make use of it. So if they're in a rocky bottom, you'll find them in crevices under rocks. They find hiding places. If they're just in a mud or a sandy bottom, then they're actually seem to be excavating holes and they're in them. And sometimes it's even just like a small ditch. It provides no protection whatsoever, but they are in it and that's their hole.
Uh-huh.
And it always amazes me about lobstermen, because I don't think many of them dive. They don't get a look underwater, but I can look and see where their traps are, and I know that that's where the most lobsters are going to be. That's where there'll be the most rock. You could look at a half mile cove that's completely gravelly or sandy, and you look out and there's three lobster buoys in one spot, and then you go to that spot and there's a ledge there. Yeah. And they know that, and have just learned it over the years.
Right. Well, one of my lobstermen does dive, and he said that there's a place that he goes and stuff. And there's like a wall. It's kind of like a clay wall.
Oh, yeah.
And it looks like a beehive of lobsters that have dug themselves, themselves in, and it's just like little things where there's a ton of lobsters just waiting to get their shell hardened up and then they come up.
Yeah, I see that down on the Cape in Sandwich, the Sandwich Town Beach. And when you look at it, it sort of reminds me of those adobe, the cliffs.
I was thinking of
And you just look at it, it's not just lobsters. Other things are up there, and they're all looking out at you. And, they all have their little houses, their little crevices in the clay. It's very cool.
Lobstermen should utilize divers the way, like, the tuna fishermen utilize pilots, right? They should.
There's a traditional, it's not as much as it used to be, but there's a traditional feeling among certain lobstermen, a paranoia. The lobstermen are generally, so lobstermen have, like, to have 800 traps, decent traps, cost you about, if you bought them all brand new, it's like $80,000. And they all get set out into the ocean, and you can't physically monitor them all the time. So they're constantly paranoid of either other lobstermen hauling their gear or of divers going in and poaching, because it's easy. It would be easy for an ethical diver, or an unethical diver, I should say, to go down. These lobstermen are baiting the traps and just open up the trap and take the lobster out. So they have traditionally, in the past, there have been confrontations that have turned ugly between lobstermen and divers. You don't hear about it so much anymore, but you hear the undercurrent of it.
Yeah. I would say the animosity is less now than it has been over the years.
I would agree with that assessment.
And my own experience, if I could say something for divers, is I've never seen a diver do that. And I'm sure that there are divers that do that, and it's whatever percentage of the population, the entire population, that is in unethical. That's the population of divers that are unethical. I'm sure it's the same as the population of lobster fishermen that are unethical.
I agree with you 100%. I'm positive.
For a diver, where's the ethical line? If you were down 80 feet and there's a lobster pot there, and there's a couple inside, but there's four outside, like poking around going,
that's fair game
here. Are those fair game?
Well, I actually don't catch lobsters, so I'm probably not the person to ask. But I would consider, if I did catch lobsters, I would consider anything that's outside of the trap to be fair game.
I would agree with that, too.
Mm-hmm. We were on Old Garden Beach, so my children are 8 and 10 now, but for years they've been helping my husband set traps and haul gear, and they know like the ins and outs. So they know V-notch, and they know eggers, and they know short, they know fair game, and all the other terminology that goes along with one claw and no claws and whatever else. And they were on Old Garden Beach, and a diver came up and had a lobster, in his hand. And the kids went over, and the diver very nicely started the, little boys, this is a lobster. And they wouldn't be like, no shit, But as they were looking at it, he started to school them very politely as if they knew nothing. And Thatcher at the time, he's 10 now, he was probably like 6 at the time. And he looked up, and all he said to the man was, that's a short. And he walked away. The diver was left there holding this little tiny lobster that he had no business having.
Dull!
That was
one of the unethical ones.
Yeah.
That's a short.
Ouch.
School by 6-year-old. Beautiful.
Well, it happens. It can happen around here. There's no other kids. Yeah.
The penalty for pulling up a short lobster is significant.
Yeah.
So anybody who does that is taking quite a risk. For something they could buy for.
So how do you get around? Because if you did it for a year, how do you get around the whole I'm cold and I don't really want to be in this water thing?
I only thought that once during the year, and that was a dive I made off of Nahant in February And I realized I was really cold through the dive, and I couldn't really figure out why I was as cold as I wasn't as warm. Finally, I looked at my computer and I saw that the water was 29 degrees. Oof. And I said at that point, you know what, I'm getting out. This is just too cold. But on that particular dive, I had gone into these rock structures off of Canoe Beach in Nahant, and they rise straight up from the bottom like towers. And most of them are solid, but a couple of them, you can go into them. They're hollowed out. And when you go in, it's sort of like being in a teepee, because it's sort of, it goes up, you know, in a cylindrical shape. And on that particular dive, I was inside of this. It was kind of dark in there. There wasn't much light coming through.
My God. I'm having heart palpitations right now. I'm not joking. I'm having heart palpitations. Like, it's like, you know, you see those videos of the guys, like, they're standing on the top of the skyscrapers without any kind of harness or something like that, and they're peering over, and you just want to throw up. That's how I feel right now. Okay?
I'm a certified diver, and I hate... that kind of shit.
Are you getting queasy as well?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you're queasy? Okay, so okay. I'm not alone. Okay,
all right. Well, this wasn't that bad. But I at some point, I turned on my lights, and I realized that there was something moving in there with me.
Oh, Jesus.
But I just,
I'd use up my whole tank.
I couldn't, like, focus on where is it? I just have a sense that something's moving. And then I realized that there was, like, a gully that ran through the side of the cave. In a circular thing, and it was about 3 feet deep, and I shined my lights in, and there were torpid fish in there.
What was?
Cunner.
They're
basically hibernating, and these were very big. Normally the cunner that you see are just little. These were big
fish.
Yeah,
I seen them, but they're big.
And they were probably...
They got teeth, too.
Oh, yeah, they do
have
teeth.
They got teeth like barracuda.
Yeah, yeah. They're about... probably about 50 or 60 of them, and they were just sort of moving slowly away from me as I... shined the light, but they were staying inside of that trough.
That was their spot, yeah.
Yeah, and I didn't want to stress them out because the water was so cold, and so I exited the
You don't
cave.
Want to stress
yeah.
them out.
Yeah, no.
Don't stress
sure.
them out.
That's okay. Why you exited slowly. Yeah.
But they're the cunner with their teeth. I can't tell you how many times I've been attacked by cunner. If you have a little bit of hair coming out from under your hood, they go after it. And they're constantly just pulling your hair.
Good times, let's go. Yeah, they're brutal when you're trying to stripe a fish or something off the dock, and they just clean out your bait because they're like little, and like 10 seconds later the bait is. You know, you spend 10 minutes trying to hide the hook so that the stripers won't detect your hook, and the cunners come and clean you out in 2 seconds. Yeah.
Are you offering to take Joey on a dive?
No, that's not
going
to anytime, Joe.
Yeah, yeah, not
anytime.
You could offer and sound like a hero, like a very generous guy, knowing that it was never going to happen. So you could offer like every day.
We can wait till the water warms up. It's nice 60 degrees, and then we'll go out.
Okay, sure. Yeah.
Where's your favorite place to dive then? So you went from Canada down to Palm Beach, right? Is that where?
Yeah, my favorite place to dive is the furthest north that I dove. It's a place called the Saguenay River. And it feeds into the St. Lawrence. And it is the most, I've never seen a place like this. The top 30 feet of it are fresh water. And then below that, it's salt water. And the top 30 feet are completely tannic from branches.
What does that mean?
Sort of brown.
Okay.
You know, sometimes you look at a
so
pond.
Brackish? Would you say brackish?
Not brackish.
What's the difference between brackish and tannic?
Well, brackish is a little bit of fresh water, a little bit of salt water. This is a very clear divide.
Okay.
The fresh water on top that looks like tea that doesn't have milk in it.
Okay.
And everything is a little bit out of focus, and everything looks brown. The way I describe
sepia
it in the
book. Sepia with your photos.
Yes, it is sepia, yeah.
Okay.
And then nice you work. Go through the Halleck Line, which is the interface between the salt water and the fresh water, and it's sort of like swimming through salad dressing. Everything gets really oily, and you can't focus on anything. And then you drop through into the salt water, and it is the blackest black that I've ever seen because no light is filtering through that tannic water above. And so even though you're only 30 or 35 feet deep, it is pitch black, but the visibility is incredible. The water is crystal clear.
Oh, crystal clear. I see.
So,
I see.
At one point, my buddy was 40 or 50 feet ahead of me, and he was shining his lights another 30 or 40 feet ahead, and I could see him, and I could see the bottom along his entire length of his beam. Wow. And you have these creatures that have adapted to this, shrimp that have very large eyes, and you know, just for the no light. And then there are places along that where it's just a sheer wall, sheer rock walls, and there are fish living on it. And they treat the wall as if it's the bottom. They have their bellies to the wall, and they're swimming up and down and sideways like that. You know, they're not facing
into it the way
that we do.
Yeah,
and that's just my favorite dive. When I am there, and I'm in that black, it's hard to believe that the rest of the world is just
like 30 feet away. Yeah, very cool.
Yeah.
Well, where can people get your book?
Wait.
First of all,
yes,
before we go any further with that line of questioning, is it available at any of the local bookstores?
It will be. I'll try to make it available.
I would think that this would be something that the bookstore of Gloucester would definitely carry. Do you want me to make a phone call for you?
Yes, please do.
Okay. Because this is something that it seems like that they would carry. They like to carry stuff that has local flavor.
Uh-huh. Well, there's quite a bit of Gloucester and Rockport in it.
Yeah.
You've got some Folly Cove in there?
Yes.
So it should be at Toad Hall.
Toad Hall as well.
Hall,
yeah, Toad Hall.
Building Center, Gift Shop, and all those other great places.
Yeah.
It's available. The print book is available on Amazon, and the ebook, and I know nothing about ebooks. I've never read an ebook in my life, but it's available wherever it is that you buy ebooks, Amazon, the iStore, wherever else.
All right, send me a link, or maybe I can find it, but I prefer not to put links to Amazon. I prefer to. We'll give them a. Is this out yet?
Yes, it is. It came out June 15th.
So how soon could you get it to the bookstore of Gloucester?
Tomorrow.
Okay, tomorrow. All right. So we're gonna give it before we would ever put a link to Amazon.
Yes.
We're gonna give you a 1 week period to get it to the bookstore of Gloucester.
That sounds great.
And then if she doesn't take it, then we'll put the link to Amazon. How's that sound?
That sounds great. Thank
sound
you very
good?
Much.
Yeah, and send me a press release next week either way, because I won't remember all this.
Okay.
And so that way there we make sure we push it. Jerry, thank you so much for coming.
Thank you for having me.
It sounds fascinating.
It really does.
Go ahead, Nicole. You got a follow-up?
Do you instruct? Do you certify other people?
No.
Or who do you recommend?
No. Well, there are many great dive shops in the area, and all of them are good. And I think that if you're looking for an instructor, pretty much anybody that you find is going to be technically capable of doing the job, and you're just looking for somebody with whom you feel a rapport with and you're comfortable with.
Yeah, I'm looking for Thatcher, for the young one, for a 10-year-old.
Yeah.
So what are some of the ones around here?
Well,
can you list off three?
There's Undersea Divers, which is in Danvers. That's one of my home shops. There's United Divers, which is in Somerville, Mass. That is the one that I use the most since I live in Somerville. And there is a dive shop here on in Rockport, Cape Ann Divers.
Hey, Ben, there you go. Rockport, that's in your backyard. That would make sense, right?
Okay.
There you go. Jerry, thank you so much for coming in.
Again,
you can stick around if you'd
me.
Like. We have a few more topics. First off, I don't know how we've gotten 48 minutes into the podcast on Fiesta Sunday and not mentioned the Fiesta, but here we are. Nicole was there. I saw you there. Ed, have you gone down?
I haven't gone down, no.
Ed has
avoided it, actually, this year.
Avoided the Fiesta.
Yes.
Paul, have you take the kayak out for Greasy Pole?
Nope. I'm, I hate to admit it, but I've never been to the Fiesta. I'm saving it up.
What the fuck is wrong with you? What is wrong with you?
I hole up. I go to. I was just talking to Brett Lanesville Packy, and there are quite a few lineup of people buying their bread and
provisions.
Eggs, provisions in Lanesville. It's just like, is this because Fiesta? We don't want to go to the other side of the island. And yeah. Oh yeah. They make a lot of money there when Fiesta's rolling, because there's these...
There's the faction of the Fiesta haters.
Well, I don't hate it. It's just I
you just don't want the crowd.
I get enough people time, at Dana-Farber. I want to be a hermit up here.
I gotcha. This Fiesta, I didn't spend a lot of time down there. I was there for an hour and a half yesterday. I saw the races and the Greasy Pole and went on a couple rides with the kids. But... From following all of our other awesome contributors' coverage, it seems like this year they went above the committee, Fiesta Committee, did some really cool special things for the 90th, including the unveiling of the new statue. And you had questions about that. I did find out from my sister. So
I read Kim Smith's post about
it. Oh, did she talk about it? Well, so what was Kim's explanation? The plaster?
From 1927 until last year, we had old Peter, who looked like that dude on Saturday Night Live. But that's another story. But it was getting old and flaky and dehydrated.
The plaster, yeah.
So they made a...
they recast it from the original.
And if you're looking at both of them at the same time, except for the slight change in expression that he does look like, the guy on the left did look like the guy from Saturday Night Live, Peter, but the new Peter is pretty close to identical.
Yeah.
And so now they have, I guess they're going to take the old one and it's probably going to end up in
the Cape Ann Museum. Awesome.
Next to
Awesome. That is so great.
And 200 years from now, you'll still be able to
The old They thing. Have the original Our Lady that was, you know, way up at the top of Our Lady of Good Voyage Church.
Right.
That statue that was on top of the church is in the museum, and you can see it. And I'm going to say, other than the FitzHenry Lane paintings that are there, which are amazing, that statue is probably my second favorite part of that museum. And then we have Blackburn's.
They got Blackburn's sure. boat.
Blackburn's
right there.
Actual boat is actually in there, which is actually pretty cool. They got too much stuff to talk about.
Is the Fresnel lens from Twin Lights still in there, or is that?
I don't know if they lend that out or if it's there all the time. I would imagine it's there.
I haven't been in a while.
Have you seen it yet?
Yeah.
It's pretty cool. I know. What am I saying? There's a million things to go see at that museum.
All the quarry tools. I love that room.
Yeah.
What a treasure! They had the exhibit from the Folly, the designers. Is it the Folly Cove designers? The woman. They did the carving, and then they did the prints. The Acorn Press, you know, Folly Cove designers.
Oh, right. She's right behind
Natty's,
the
Natty's
in Rockport.
Yeah,
but she has the old press.
She has the old press, but they had an exhibit there. God, I can't believe I'm freaking. But if you haven't been, this is one of the things I tell out of towners, like, must do when you come into town. So anyway, I always recommend Thomas Lennon and the Maritime Heritage Center and the Cape Ann Museum. Those are three. Would you agree with me that those are three absolute wins? Like, they're definitely wins.
Oh yeah,
right,
absolutely.
Can you think of anything that you would put over those three as a must do?
Ooh.
I think it depends
on the age of the we swear by the water taxi, the shuttle, or the trolley that goes from stage four.
A whale watch. Yeah. I've never, to this day, never been on a whale watch, but every person I've ever spoken to that's been on a whale watch has said to me, it's like you're living with real-life dinosaurs.
Yeah.
They are coming that close to the boat and everything else. Yeah. And I would say Halibut Park, a walk around Halibut Park.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
Yeah.
That's the first time I was on Cape Ann around 1978. I was brought up and we walked around Halibut Park and I said, I want to live here. And 40 years later, bought a house about a mile away.
There you go. Is it that far from your house?
Well, 400 yards, something like
that. All right, I didn't give everybody an opportunity. So would you put anything above what we've already mentioned?
I actually mentioned one thing to you today that you didn't been to is Red Rock. It's a nice little hike. It's up 133 by the storage place. If you'll see the cars parked along the side of it, or you see what it looks like.
It's marked. Is it marked?
And it's marked, but it's inside. You really don't know until you park there.
Yep.
But you park there, and it's a very easy hike, and the panoramic view of Cape Ann is just gorgeous up there. I love going up there in the fall. It's beautiful.
Oh, with the foliage.
All the foliage, yes.
What's the name of the park?
Red Rock.
Red
Rock. It's
Rock.
Not a park, so to speak. It's more like a trail. Mm-hmm. And it goes up, up, up. Very easy climb.
But bikers do it, too.
Huh?
By biking.
Oh, yeah.
I wonder if Ken Lawler is up there.
Oh, all the time.
Ken Lawler would know about that.
And there's rock climbers. There's actually a face that, you know, I'm sure, for me, I'm not going to climb on the face of a rock, but there's rock climbers that use this face for their practicing, I'm sure.
Is there chalk all over the wall?
No, you can actually watch them. I've sat there and, you know.
No, but when you do that kind of rock climbing, you're always
getting chalk. And
dipping your fingers in chalk. And
yeah.
Nicole, you have anything?
I don't know. I mean, the list is, we try to do it all, but I was just mentioning the trolley. I think if you're new here and you haven't seen a lot, doing the water taxi and listening to Stevie or the other captains give the history again of not only the marine science, the maritime history, and going in and out, looking at the boats and Cape Hondice and whatever.
Any of those tours, because he has the lighthouse tour.
Yeah, and that's
he has the lobstering tour. Do they still do the lobstering tour on the
boat? They do the lobstering, they do the 2.5 hour lighthouse tour, now the new Anasquam River tour, which I think, I haven't done it with him, but I've been up and down the Anasquam, you know, hundreds of times, and I think that a lot of people who live here don't have that opportunity. If you don't have a friend with a boat, you go over the Anasquam. If you're lucky, you spend some time down in the Anasquam, but you never go up and down the river.
Yeah.
And to kind of see the other side of where you drive, it's just so beautiful there. And to go down Jones's Creek and whatnot and see the eelgrass and the beaches, and to go to that part of Wingersheek instead of the populated end of Wingersheek is great. What was I just going to... Oh, well, you were gone. Nothing at all educational about this at all, but we've been going down and playing bocce ball. And we call tailgating on the boulevard. We've been bringing breakfast and granola and yogurt and packing some orange juice. And
do they have the balls there? They leave the balls there?
No, we got my dad a set for Father's Day, or for Christmas, and we got Freddie a set for Father's Day.
That's brilliant.
When my sister and a few people, we went down and did the tulips, and the balls were there, and my little nephews were playing bocce.
Yeah, maybe they do. Yeah, we have.
That's so cool.
But no, literally, we got there early and just left the tailgate open. We did. We literally tailgated down there, and we have not packed anything better than orange juice and whatever. But maybe we will.
Whatever. In quotation marks and whatever.
But it's such a great thing. I mean, you're right there. All the flags right in the boulevard. You see the boat traffic coming and going. You know,
yeah.
It's such a great location.
Tremendous.
My fear is it's going to start getting really crowded. But the boys actually ask to do it now, which I think is awesome. You know, go over to the marina, swim in the pool.
Gives you something to do,
You know,
yeah.
And all of this is like no cost
free.
Or like ridiculously cheap. I mean, it's just the options are endless. I have a question. Maybe you know, and I know I can Google it or get on it. But I was taking pictures of those scanning things. Your girls were just here too. We were talking about that new card set. You can track the cards, but
sneaky cards.
I used to have an app that would scan those like barcode things or whatever that you
barcode
see everywhere.
Scanner, yeah.
So I've never actually done the Harbor Walk in its entirety, but now even down by the bocce ball courts and the fisherman statue and the fisherman's wife statue, there's those little scanning things.
QR codes.
So yeah, so if you have an app, you do that, right? Is it like a scavenger hunt now, or is it more of a just it gives you information when
there's
you...
There's information links, there's videos, informational stuff. There's a lot that goes with it.
So we're
Catherine
doing
Ryan was involved
summer
in that.
Staffed... we're doing an art walk camp for a week where the children will come and retrace the footsteps of some of the famous artists and sit and draw.
Winslow Homer and Fitzhugh Lane and Hopper.
Yeah, and have them do the whole harbor walk at the same time. So keep on meaning to go down and do it myself with the kids before I try to bring a group of 15.
You should contact
students.
Catherine Ryan, because I bet she would love to help you with that. Because that's the kind of thing that is right in her wheelhouse.
Yeah, we started to do it the other day, and then we got sidetracked with, we went to go take a picture of, Freddie's mom has a stone down by the fisherman statue, and a memoriam stone, and I saw some from your family, too, down there, I think. But so we got sidetracked taking pictures of that, and then the rain came in, and so I didn't even have time to download the app, but I wanted to do the whole walk. So that's a great thing, too, totally free, great way to see the harbor, you know, harbor front,
and learn about
locations, so...
Jerry, when you're in town, what is some besides diving? Because I know you're all about diving. You're the diving guy now. Like, you have no other interest, right, except for diving. No, like, what are some of the things you like to do in on Cape Ann?
Well, I like to go out on Bearskin Neck and walk around the point there and in the shops. I think it's beautiful there.
Yeah.
And if you're not going to dive, but you're going to go in the water, I would suggest getting a mask and going to Back Beach at the left end, and right along the, at the left end of the beach, the sand rock interface is very shallow. If it's a sunny day, the sun is streaming down. There's a lot of fish and a lot of invertebrate life there, and it's a great way to spend an hour.
The boys just got those full face masks with the snorkel, you know, that cover the holes. So I've been taking them to the pool to practice.
What is that? What is that? That's something new? It's not just goes over the eyes?
Yeah, it's a whole.
Oh, wait, wait. Don't show me right now because it'll take up time. Do, can you, are you going to do a post about it?
Sure.
Because that's kind of the thing. You're always looking for topics, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm interested because I might want to get them for the kids.
I will show them and I'll do a post, but that would be great. They're looking for a place that they can go that they actually might see something.
Yeah, the left end of the beach, right along the sand and the rocks.
Good to know.
I wonder if Niles Beach, you know, on the right-hand side of Niles Beach. Oh, there's a lot of tide pools over there and stuff.
Niles, more for a diver than for a snorkeler. It's very muddy there, and it's unusual. There's not a lot of bottoms like that in close around Cape Ann. And if you're a diver, you see things there that you don't see anything else, any place else, that they're living in the mud.
I don't want to go swimming there anymore. Just ruin Niles Beach for me. Actually, I don't go in the water anyway. I go to Niles Beach. I don't even go in the water.
You don't get your ankles wet anymore.
That's where I learned. I took swimming lessons because it was right around the corner from my house. When I was a kid, they had the teenage lifeguards gave you swimming lessons back when you were like 8 years old.
Yeah.
That's where I was there. Yeah, that rock.
Knew what was underneath.
And they never used to comb that beach either. It was just all rocks. So like my memories of you know, learning how to swim when I was a child was like with my bare feet trying to get to the water and, you know, just so that was my so there's that. Nicole, I want to get back to you. Your brother-in-law, Ricky Schraft, Dicka, it was on Wicked Tuna this year.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, my girls are into the show now.
Sure.
I know he worked at Compass Seafood where they offload a bunch of the fish. Yeah. How did he get a slot on the boat? Do you know how that all went down?
I don't know if I know the actual story. I know I've heard it, but so forgive me if I'm wrong. But yeah, so he worked for years with PJ, right down at Compass Seafood, and on the other end, at the buyer end, and then Hebert, needed somebody on the boat, and asked Ricky, or Ricky asked, and based on the show, they had a rocky start, and then they got in a groove and had a really great season. We were on the boat a lot at the end of the season, just going down to see them when they were done filming, and the fish count got higher and higher, and we can say that now that the show is over, but they ended up having a really great season together. So, and he's, they're going to start filming again in a few weeks, and he's booked for season two. So, definitely fun for the kids to watch, for sure.
I'm sure, I mean, my kids don't have a stake in it, and they love the show.
Yeah. So Freddie, it's funny because Ricky is on the show, but Freddie was a tuna fisherman forever. When I first met Freddie back in our 20s or whatever, it was he was always coming back from some exotic location on a sport fishing boat, and then he moved back full time, and I met him. So it's fun for them to see what Freddie used to do, but they don't think I'm not the cool one in the family by any stretch of the imagination. But I worked with Mark Gottfried for 4 summers. He had asked me to come down and.
Did you ever use one of the big sawzall things cutting
the
heads off?
That's why it's a funny story, because I saw him at Halibut Point, and he was talking to Freddie, and I was doing a lot of photography at the time, and he's like, oh, we want you to come work and take pictures of the core samples, and I want to start emailing them to Japan, to the market, right away so they can start bidding on the fish. I'm like, all right, great. So I went down there with my camera thinking, I'm just going to go stand there, stay clean, and take pictures. And very soon I was in muck boots and shoveling heron and sawing heads off of tuna fish. And I would go from work at school to doing that to Fenway Park to shoot the Red Sox all in the same day. And we'd go to Fenway Park like with scales all over me, and that was a big hit. But the kids like to see that Uncle Ricky's on the Wicked Tuna, and I can show them what I used to do. And it's all part of growing up on the island.
It is. So we used to have tuna buyers that worked out of our out of the dock here, and these tuna buyers, like, you know, the tuna are to them, but like, we used to handle tens of thousands of fish a day, and they'd have one fish come in and like want the whole operation to cease for their one fish, you know, and which is, you know, the fish is worth some money and everything else. But like, we stopped handling tuna because it became like, okay, you know, tie up the door for, you know, 45 minutes while other boats are stacked up wanting to offload. But the cool part about it, when, you know, when I was your kid's age down here at the dock, was seeing them with these hand saws lopping off the heads of these giant tuna. You know, the heads themselves weigh like 80-100 pounds, and taking all the guts out, and the guts could fill up a fish tote. And it's just wild, just wild. And
packing it with ice, you have down to a science, you know.
Yeah.
Oh my god. Gaffing it off the, you know, running it on the forklift, putting it in the ice, doing the core sample. It was very much as a, you know, it's a dance when these fish come in. And then every once in a while, once a season or twice a season, the white dove would come in.
Yeah,
with the 80 or 90 or 100, 150 fish they were allowed to catch at once.
Yeah.
That was an all day really good.
They had, there was only a couple of those permits up and down the whole coast. They had one of the original permits that allowed them to seine for tuna. So they like nowadays they probably want to put you in, you know.
Yeah.
It's like, and they would just come in with like that many tuna, like, and offload them in the process. Do they hire like a ton of people to come in and help you guys with the manpower?
Yeah, well, just keeping track of all the fish. When you tag the fish, obviously those little, you know, plastic rings and the numbers, but I mean, we were talking like 160 fish at a time, and
chaos.
And they were constantly, trucks taking them, they're coming, taking the first 12 fish, taking them right to Boston, putting them on whatever airline that is, I forget the name now, sending them right over to Japan, but then knowing which ones were going to stay local, which restaurant wanted one, and I mean, it was a, you know, it was an intense 12 hours at a time. But
I wanted to do a shout out, change it up just a little bit, shout out to Sherry D. Lorenzo, because she, my sister told me this yesterday, so I'm assuming this is from her. She commissioned these St. Peter medallions, and you can only get them at the Beauport Hotel in the gift shop. They are really beautiful.
Are they just like your sister's cookies, which are unbelievable?
They're unbelievable. No, they're really beautiful medallions, you know, for people that are into fiesta and stuff like that. And
but the same image, is that what you mean? The image on the,
yeah. It's the head. It would be like St. Peter's head. Yeah. Like, you know, usually those saint things have the head.
Yeah.
But Sherry commissioned them. You can only, the manufacturer, I don't think even sells them. I think you have to get them to a Beauport hotel. They're beautiful. And they're, I think Felicia said, so I'm only going by her. I haven't researched this. I think they're $90 a piece. And they're engraved on the back and everything else. For Fiesta lovers, total awesome collector's edition. Okay, here's some. Jerry, this is going to, so we're going to track this now. One of my pet peeves that is starting to drive me absolutely bananas, because we have more and more like high-end guests coming on the podcast, or people that have interesting stories to tell, but they come in and then inevitably I do a post and then Kim does a post and we put it on Facebook and we tag these people and they may like it, the post, but liking it doesn't fucking do much.
Share it.
You have to share it, okay? Because if you don't share it, you came in, you did the work to promote your book, right, Jerry?
Oh, yeah.
Now, if you have Facebook, and we do the effort to edit the podcast, to put it up, to put in the tags, put your name, get your name right, to share it with you, and you don't share it with the people that presumably follow you on your social media sites, you're a fucking idiot, okay? Because it's happened way too many times. It's driving me up a wall. I don't mean to sound bitter, but maybe I'm a little bitter because we're putting in the time.
In a week, you will be bitter.
This is the brother through donuts all over again.
No, this week you will not be bitter.
I will not be bitter, but this, not to signal, you know, you have a grace period. But
you will, Jerry. But
do what you want, Jerry. But like, I'm on a rampage right now with these guests that come in. And sit here for an hour. We talk. We do our best to, you know, talk about all the strengths of what they're trying to promote, and they don't share it, and it drives me crazy.
I feel that way with things that we highlight, like the and now they'll listen and I'll eat these words. But like that houseboat in Charlestown, that we stayed
the
on.
The turtle or something?
You know, yeah, the green turtle. So I do a big blog post. It gets a lot of traffic. I have at least, you know, 3 friends now who have booked it as a result, which is, you know, a good chunk of money for them. And I just wrote something on their Facebook page and I scanned through just out of curiosity, and they had never shared
nothing.
The post I wrote about them on their own Facebook page, which seems like, I don't care, but it seems like it's kind of...
No, you do care, and you should care, because you put in the effort, and I get it.
Yeah.
I totally understand where you come from. It drives me up a wall. So anyone that listens to this, I'm just saying. Okay, my last topic for the day. This is something that Ed and I were talking about this earlier. I have a fascination with fire and charcoal grilling. If you haven't, you don't follow the blog, but you would know this, that I have a passion for charcoal grilling. But it seems to be fire as well, because I have the wood stove now, I have the pellet stove. And Ed brought up a thing. He thinks it's an innate thing with men and fire, that like we have a passion for being able to control fire. Do you think that could be a thing, Paul?
Oh, absolutely.
What's the Latin term for that, Paul?
There's got to be one, but I can... if you looked at all my childhood photos, you may not notice, but once you point it out, it's pretty obvious. I don't have any eyebrows from when I'm 8 years old to about 14, because my job was to take the garbage out to the 55-gallon drum and light it on fire in the alley a couple times a week. That's what
garbage?
You did. Yeah. Well, all the trash.
Okay.
But you'd...
Where did you live? Where did you live?
Downtown Indianapolis. Well, this was, you know, 1965. You were allowed to burn
365
in the 60s around here.
Okay.
But I wasn't the only kid who would go through the trash and find the glass jars with lids, the hairspray can, all the things that might explode. And you sort them out, and then you get the fire going really well, and then you put those on top. And yeah, that's where my eyebrows went.
There you go.
I also said that it was probably part of our primitive DNA as far as fire, because I mean, it was such a protective source in so many different ways. I mean, 1, the heat, 2, cooking, 3,
keeping animals away.
Kept the animals away from where you were at that time. And in fact, it was funny, I was telling him, I was up in the desert mountains in Arizona. It's 100-something degrees out at night. I still have a fire going.
Still have a fire going.
Yeah. I enjoy the fire.
The love of my life, Caitlin, has a knack. She has a fire pit knack for acknowledging the fire pit and placing her seat in direct line of the prevailing winds, she then complaining about the smoke of a fire pit. I don't know what it is, but maybe we have to have an instructional thing of checking out where the wind is generally going and putting her on the opposite side.
Get a small flag in case you can't see.
I thought that's a good. You know, remember the Huffies had the orange, the triangular flag that they put on so kids wouldn't get run over by bikes in traffic.
Mm-hmm.
I might get one of those.
Put one on each chair around the fire to see which.
No, I'll put the one where the smoke is generally going, so I can. Focus her attention to maybe sit on the opposite side.
I have been Facebooking with Caitlin about cleaning vents, but that's another story.
Cleaning vents. She can all listen. She's dying for me. Okay. I love my Caitlin. She's awesome. And she's really good. Did you see her?
I had it done twice. I love breathing.
You have a deacon. So we're talking about. So I have a CPAP machine. That the mask that I actually have selected. I try to get the least invasive or obtrusive one that just goes over my nose and like my mouth and chin.
I think
so. Not wearing like something like this.
I think we need photos.
I'm going to tell you something.
I don't know how Caitlin hasn't done that yet, for the record. I'm a little bit disappointed that there's no photos yet.
It really, you know, the
you
funny
know, or, so, you know who should be doing this? What I always call them the wrong name. I always call him Squirrel. Rabbit. I can't believe Rabbit hasn't taken a picture of you with this on.
Well, he's usually not in bed with me at night.
We have plenty of pictures of him sleeping.
But I do. But so here's the thing. Like, my thought process of getting the mask, the smallest mask that would just fit over my nose and then there, it really, there is that, with the headgear that goes around to keep it in, it really doesn't matter if you have the full face or that, because it both looks completely ridiculous and horrible. Like, but the mask that I selected doesn't really fit my face, so this air, like this constant stream of air just going right at my eyeballs, so they feel like they're dried out and cracking, like after 20 minutes of having this mask on. It is hard. It's horrible. Horrible.
You gotta get him one of the full face.
Right, I'm gonna show it to you. Right, you might as well have that.
You know, so that was the first thing. I didn't say it in the segment, but that's exactly what I was thinking. But I'm gonna go full face. I'm getting refitted for a full face CPAP mask.
I like your cousin's comment. Nothing spells sexy like the CPAP.
No, nothing. Nothing. Yeah. And if you don't think I'm a little subconscious of it, you have to like it. You don't take that thing out until after your business is taken care of. Because nothing, like, it's
really?
Hot.
That seems a little obvious, but.
Yeah, that'd be a fetish. So some girls might be into that kind of thing. There's this fetish for everybody, Ed.
You got that later going.
ENTs, maybe you have some.
It's so awful. It's so awful. But people, have, you know, 97% of the people that have responded have said it has been life altering for them. So. I'm gonna give her another shot. I have to, but she. Paul has to bring it up that all you have to do is get an operation. So now she's on. She's the one who pushed me to get this CPAP thing, and now if this doesn't work out, do me a favor. Do not suggest like some homeopathic remedy, because that'll be the next thing that she's gonna have.
I'm a scientist. You're not gonna get that from me.
Thank you.
All I do is encourage you to. Have an ENT dude take a peek up your nose, and you know, you've been a hard worker all your life. I played baseball and maybe, you know, hung out in bars, but when the ENT dude looked up my nose, he said, "Holy crap, you busted your nose 5 times at least." And really, I didn't even know I broke it once. But he rooted it all out, and 2 weeks later, oh my God, yeah, I mean, my life before and my life after, it's like two different lives. That I can run around the block and have my mouth closed. I was a mouth breather.
I'm a mouth breather.
If I was doing anything that required oxygen, now I can have my mouth shut. It's amazing.
Yeah.
Like breathing.
So my brief vacation time is going to be spent fucking recovering from the rotor-rooted job on my nose. Awesome.
Oh, yeah, awesome. You have these tubes stuck up your
nose. So sexy. All right, GlosterCast 230 is in the books. Thanks for coming in, everybody. Fiesta Cast 2017, even though we barely talked about Fiesta.
Viva.
So wait.